Hi, everyone, and welcome to DevRaga Personal Finance. My name's DevRaga, and I'm your host. And in this episode, we will specifically look at some of the mistakes doctors routinely make when it comes to their money, finances, and sometimes even personal life and careers. Now, a common misconception is that all doctors are rich. The more accurate statement would be, doctors on average earn more per year than other professions. But this does not always translate to higher net worth status. That is a way more geekier way to look at this episode. But in this episode, I will tackle some of the problems doctors get themselves into, often unnecessarily, and often through their own misadventure. Even if you're not a doctor, you may be surprised how common and simple some of these mistakes are. So I think it's still worthwhile listening in to make sure you don't fall into these traps. And in my view, the principles of money and concepts, it's exactly the same, no matter if you earn $10,000, $100,000, or $1 million a year. Now, this episode is quite lengthy, so we might actually have to split it into two episodes. Let's get started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you want me to discuss a specific topic, or if you have a specific question, don't hesitate to contact me via Twitter or via Facebook. For those of you that are new to the channel, remember the three main aims: education, empowerment, and entertainment. Now, what's the first mistake? Number one, not having a budget. This sounds so simple, but it's actually very common amongst a lot of people, including doctors and probably most other professions as well. There may be plenty of reasons why that they're not able to construct a budget, even a simple one. Busy, life happens, training, hours at work. Last thing I want to do is to create a budget after a 24-hour call. But doctors are very good at dishing out instructions to their patients about health. What do we say? Eat well, sleep well, exercise, don't get your wound wet, come back and review me in 6 weeks' time. Don't get your plaster wet. Make sure you put less salt in your diet. Make sure you put less sugar in your diet. Don't smoke. Don't drink too much alcohol and never do drugs. So why is it that we dish out all these instructions, this sort of lifestyle advice? But when you think about a budget, it's kind of a lifestyle advice when it comes to money. The thing about creating budgets is it's boring. It's not exciting. And I can't think of anything worse than creating budgets after a long day's work. I get it. That's why I believe in simplicity. I believe in simple budgets, which are easy and reproducible. My budget fits on the back of an envelope. Now, I've done an episode 218. If you're interested, where I talk specifically about the various styles of budgeting. Without budgets, without a radar, you don't know where your money is going. If you don't like itemized budgets, which I must admit, I really hate, and I don't do myself, just use a simple principle. My principle is the 30-30-20-20 rule. And this is how it works. 20% after-tax money is my money. Pay myself first because I'm the most important person on this planet. Number two is 30% of mortgage expenses and housing expenses. Make sure that you don't overcommit on your mortgage, on your rent, on your housing expenses. Granted, if you live in Sydney or Melbourne or one of the metro cities, it can be quite difficult, but it is doable. Number three is 30% of living expenses. Make sure you don't fall traps to lifestyle creep. This is very common in the medical world. You become an intern, you become a resident, all of a sudden you're earning $100,000, $110,000 a year. Then you become a registrar, goes up to $120,000 to $200,000 a year. Then you become a consultant, may even go up to $300,000 a year, may even go up to $600,000 a year. And the temptation is to spend all that money. The temptation is, I deserve a new car, I deserve a bigger house, I deserve my kids go to private school because now I'm a consultant. I've got money, so why don't I spend it? I have nothing against spending money. What I do have something against is spending money that you don't have, that you haven't budgeted for. So 30% living expenses, make sure you try and trim it as much as you possibly can. And lastly, 20%, luxuries, emergency funds, miscellaneous, whatever it is. Now, let's say your mortgage expenses are a little bit more than 30%. That's okay. That means you spend less on your luxuries. Let's say your living expenses is a little bit more than 30%. That's okay. You spend less money on luxuries, but you never, ever spend less on your pay yourself money. That is fixed. That is never to be touched, never to be seen ever again, straight to investments. And if you've listened to my podcast since when I first started, I'll talk about all the various types of investments and the various concepts. And I'm a great believer in things like superannuation, property, stock market investing via index funds, etc. Now, I actually recently spoke to a couple, not financial advice, but recently they sort of told me, they said, we don't really know where the money is going. And you know what? $10,000 a month, both of them doctors, $10,000 a month was actually missing from their budget. I said, well, where's it going? And the answer was they didn't know. I said, well, what you need to do is engage an advisor or engage a budget planner or someone that could help you create a budget, because clearly they're making around $50,000 a year after tax income. So $10,000 going missing, that's a significant amount. That's 20% of their income a month that's just vanishing into thin air. They had no idea where it was going. But then they followed up with me a few weeks later, and they did do that. They went and engaged a professional, and it turns out that it was accounted for. It was on debt. $10,000 a month they're spending on debt, not even investment debt. It was kind of consumer debt. Now, if you want more for housing expenses, like I said, and then you need to compromise in other categories, there is no way about it. And like I said, and reiterate, you must never compromise on your pay yourself first 20% after tax money. That is a given, and that should be automated wherever possible. Now, I've done an episode again on automation in episode 117. It's one of the most powerful tools in personal finance. As boring as it is, it will get you out of trouble. Number two is not having a written financial plan or goals. I mean, I see this all the time. Similar to not having a budget, not having a financial plan is a recipe for disaster. A budget is more of a short-term time frame approach, maybe a monthly budget or a yearly budget or maybe two-yearly budget or a quarterly budget, whilst a financial plan and goal setting is more of a longer-term frame approach. I've done a detailed episode on this topic in episode 90, if you're interested. It's basically a roadmap for the future, a guideline. Doctors love policies. We love guidelines and procedures. And in 2023, several hospitals went through accreditation cycles, right? So we loved looking over our policies, perfecting them, and then shelving it for the next accreditation cycle. So a financial plan is a bit like that. It comes up once in a while, and then you go back and get stored as a reference item. And whenever you think you're deviating away from it, you pick it up, you read it, it resets. It gives you a bit of a memory jog. This is what you're meant to be doing. And this is what you're going to be heading to in the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years time. You may wish to have a financial plan split into short term, maybe medium term and long term. And the components of a financial plan and the major ones, let's have a look at that. There are 8 main components of a financial plan. Number one is financial goals, right? You need to write them down, perhaps split them into short-term, medium-term, and long-term. So maybe in the long-term, your financial goal might be, I want to achieve $2.5 to $5 million in net worth assets that are income-producing. That's okay. Once you have a vision, once you have a plan, you got to write it down. Short-term goals might be to pay off some debt, particularly bad debt, consumer debt, or even some mortgage debt that you want to get rid of. As I was speaking to a colleague just even today, he wants to get rid of his mortgage because he feels that he will sleep better at night. He's got young kids and he wants shelter and security, so he doesn't have a large mortgage hanging over his head all the time, which means once you're free from those shackles, you don't have to work as much. Medium-term goals may be to save up, maybe to buy a house, or educational goals. You might have kids, you want to put them in independent schools, etc. And longer-term goals, like I said, maybe setting a retirement date or time plan with a net worth portfolio target and how much you need to retire on. It's really important. When I speak to people, the first question I say is, how much money do you think you need to retire on? And 99% of the time, they don't know. And that's a problem. Now, the second thing about a financial plan is net worth statement. You can't get somewhere without knowing where you are in the start. A net worth statement is really important, and it takes into account all of your assets minus all of your liabilities. And this includes things like super, investments, homes, other types of investments, and any other debts you may have. Your income has nothing to do with your net worth statement. High-income individuals often don't have a correlation with high net worth. Earlier in your career, your net worth is likely to be negative, as hopefully you reach equilibrium and reach a higher positive state later in life. That's not unusual. And the most common reason why doctors get into negative net worth early on is help debt. We borrow money from the government in order to do medicine. Thank you, taxpayer, because we're going to be repaying those taxes in hundreds, if not millions of dollars throughout the lifetime of our career. Not a bad investment from the government, that is, and the taxpayer. Number three is budgeting. Your financial plan needs to include a brief budgetary overarching statement, also your cash flow situation. Now, cash flow is different to budgets, right? For example, my cash flow isn't that great because I always direct it towards investments. So I don't have large wads of cash lingering around in my account apart from the emergency funds. My concerns are mainly about investments. So apart from a generous amount of emergency funds, I don't maintain much of a cash position all the time. Number four is retirement plans. Part of a financial plan and goal setting document is to plan for retirement, of course. That's the whole point. You need to have a rough idea about when you think you will wind down, and this may not be completely off duties. Most doctors can't and don't completely wind down. I can't see myself completely winding down. So I'm going to be in my 60s, maybe early 70s, potentially terrorizing medical students. Now, for example, for me, again, I plan to continue doing financial education. I plan to do mentoring junior doctors. I plan to perhaps do registrar teaching or provide executive level support. And I plan to terrorize medical students. I might provide external reviews and opinions at medical panels. I kind of do that already on the side. Now, the other rule of thumb I use to plan for retirement is 60 to 70% of my current earnings is what I'm planning to have in retirement from an income standpoint if I'm not working. A lot of doctors who earn $300,000, $500,000, $700,000, $1 million a year, all of a sudden think they can and will live on $60,000 per year. Now, $60,000 per year is nothing to sneeze at, but it's not practical. How are you going to change your life to potentially 10% of your current income? It's not feasible. It's not realistic to think like this, particularly when you don't factor in inflation. Recently, one of my colleagues said that she probably earns about $500,000, and she thinks in her retirement, she's maybe 42, that she'd be able to retire on $50,000. I said, well, $50,000 in 20 years' time is not going to be much money, so you've got to inflation adjust that. It's probably going to be closer to $100,000 to $150,000 in terms of future-proofing that income by the time she dies, which is going to be at the age of 84 on average today if you're born in Australia. So I think it's always worthwhile to plan for more, and if you don't need it, give it away. This provides options for your retirement planning. Number five is part of the financial goal and plan setting. You must include insurance. This is a very big topic, and I've done plenty of episodes on this before, but as a bare minimum, I think doctors should have at least life insurance, income protection, and trauma insurance. TPD, I think, is not entirely necessary, and I do have an insurance episode with an insurance expert, Phil Thompson, coming up in the near future. And usually, TPD isn't occupation-specific depending on the insurer, and the definition of total and permanent disability varies, so I think the previous three insurances will cover for most scenarios. In fact, trauma is probably the most claimed, income protection second, and life the third. But insurance is there to protect you and your family. You're not going to profit from it, so I really hate it when people say online, oh, insurance is not worth it. What's worth it is an investment. Insurance is not really an investment. It is going to cost you money, right? The actuaries have done their sums. You are not going to profit from having insurance, but when you need it the most is when it's most useful. I've had, unfortunately, colleagues pass away at a very young age, but one colleague passed away from pancreatic cancer. And the best thing that he told me was while he was dying, he was at peace because he got the life insurance payout and he knew that his wife and his children were secure. And that to me at the time didn't really ring in. But now that I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm an uncle, I'm a son, it makes sense. It's really important. And I do not want to leave my family behind and leave a mess. It's a really good and decent thing to do for your loved ones. Now, that's your financial plan. Now, the third mistake that a lot of doctors do, and then we'll take a bit of a break and we'll come back for the fourth and fifth, is just borrowing too much money, either to buy a home, to buy a car, maybe you buy a boat. This is a huge risk for doctors. Buying too much house or car happens a lot. You don't have to be a doctor. In fact, any profession, just don't buy too much house. The critical times this is a risk is when you go from medical student to internship, when you go from internship to residency, when you go from residency to registrarship, and of course, the post-fellowship euphoria when you go from registrarship to consultancy. For those long-time listeners, you know to keep your mortgage and housing expenses to less than 30% of your after-tax income. I've already drilled that into you over the years. One of the problems of rebuttal to this is, Dev, we live in Melbourne. We live in Sydney, and therefore it's actually not that easy to afford a home within this limit of 30% after tax. That's a good point. It just might mean that you might have to move rural or regional and traverse. Do your trips. Yeah, life would suck. But life sucks as a registrar being on call 24/7 anyway, right? So life would suck even more. So I don't think that's a valid argument. I don't think a valid argument is we live in Sydney, we want to live in a Sydney, and we're going to overcommit because that's what we want to do, and then work our asses off to pay that mortgage off and then be extremely vulnerable every month on a Tuesday afternoon to what the RBA governor says, because that makes or breaks whether we have positive or negative cash flow that particular month. I just don't think that's a way to live. That's me. That's Dev Raka principle. Maybe it's not the listeners, but I just think it's stressful. And it's a real temptation to buy too much car or too much house. I get the fact that housing affordability is an issue. I'm concerned. I have kids. I'm worried that they might not be able to afford houses. I also get the point that housing security is really important. I personally think it's ridiculous that people that live overseas who are not citizens or residents of Australia are buying and allowed to buy residential property at a whim. Now, call me a protectionist, but I think if you live in this country, you're a resident, I think you should have some benefits. And part of that, I think, should be you should be able to buy property at reasonably affordable prices, not at ridiculous market values. Now, that might be a controversial view, but I don't think it might be that controversial. If you need to breach the 30% rule when it comes to housing cost, then you'll need to sacrifice on other elements of your budgets like discretionary spending and luxuries or travel. You never ever compromise on the pay yourself approach because it's a huge risk not to invest, even if housing costs are higher than normal. And I see this all the time with doctors. They spend all their money and they reach the age of 35, 36, 37, 38 and they're consultants and they've got nothing invested. It's a huge risk. With interest rates being so high, and I'm recording this in Feb 2024, and likely to remain high for a while yet, I just don't think interest rates are going to drop in the next sort of 6 months or so. It's completely fine to pay off your debt. There's nothing wrong with paying off your mortgage. I find it absurd that doctors convince themselves that somehow it's okay to have a house debt, and it's better to keep it maximized so one day they can upgrade and then convert it to an investment property. That's the dream. That's the selling point, right? Now, that's all fine, and there isn't anything wrong with playing money into the offset so effectively you're reducing your interest payments, which is akin to reducing your debt. That's fine, but if you don't want an offset and you want a redraw, that's fine as well. I've discussed the various differences between redraws and offsets in one of my earlier episodes, and I encourage you to go back and listen to that, because a redraw is not the same as an offset, which is often a common misconception amongst the medical community. Now, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I've got two more potential mistakes that doctors tend to make. And then we might call it quits for this episode. And then in part two, I'll do maybe another few more. Be right back.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Now, welcome back. Number four is lifestyle creep. You've heard about this concept, and I've done episodes on this. I think that was probably earlier in my podcasting career when it was actually called Devaraga Personal Finance with me and my iPhone inside my Tesla. If I remember right, maybe between episode 30 and 32, if you're interested. In fact, go back and listen to that episode. You listen to raw Devaraga, me and an iPhone inside my Tesla. As I said, that's it. Me just basically ranting and talking about random stuff. So Devaraga 2024 is, you know, potentially a bit more professional than Devaraga, I don't know, whenever that was, 2018, I suppose. And I cannot stress how risky lifestyle creep is for everyone, especially for doctors. The issue is the incomes of doctors increase exponentially towards the end of their training. And as a result, it's almost a rite of passage to overcommit and then do things which could potentially impair their lifestyle. The issue is, right, the incomes of doctors increase exponentially, particularly towards the end of their training, particularly when you go from senior registrar to consultancy level over a period of 2 or 3 years. And as a result, it's almost, you know, people just feel overwhelmed and euphoric to overcommit. And then they keep spending the money. And that's how lifestyle creep enters your life. Now, this includes things like buying a bigger home, buying a bigger car, private school for kids, which is arguable, lifestyle holidays, upgrade on flights, home help domestic services, better restaurants, eating out, better holidays. Now, here's a simple strategy to handle lifestyle creep. And this is why, you know, I'm a great follower of White Coat Investor, Dr. Jim Daly. In fact, we interviewed Dr. Daly recently, and that's going to be released in the near future results. So stay tuned for that. And he mentions this frequently on his podcast, live like a resident when you're a registrar, converted to Australian terms, live like a registrar when you're a consultant, and live like a junior consultant when you're a mid to senior consultant. It's a very, very simple principle, which I really, really like, and it resonates. And that's kind of what I did. Now, the legitimate question is, I know what everyone's thinking, Dev, you're telling me I should sacrifice my entire life. Then what's the point of living? Why earn money when not you can't enjoy it? This is a fair question. A lot of doctors, a lot of listeners, you know, go through potentially years of training, potentially years of quote unquote abuse, because you look at what's happening to junior doctors across the state of Victoria, underpaid, overworked, not paid overtime, all that sort of stuff. Now, my point of view on this is I'm not saying do this forever. All I'm saying is consider it for around 5 years or so. Then you'll realize how powerful this behavior change is, and the lifestyle change is literally life-saving. I think the first 5 to 10 years of a doctor's career is the most crucial to get your habits right. Don't spend too much money. And when you reach around mid-consultancy level, you will realize all that hard work comes to fruition, provided you've invested and you paid yourself first. And then you can splurge and do whatever you want from a lifestyle point of view. This is assuming you don't have competing interests, you don't have any health problems, family commitments, family breakdowns, divorce, which is always difficult. I know the divorce rates for healthcare workers is a little bit higher than average, likely due to many hours spent at work, which means lack of family time or opportunity to divert their attentions to things they probably shouldn't be diverted to. And I'm being a realist. So it's a real problem. Let's use an example to highlight this concept. Amy is a surgical resident. She's happy to receive the letter of offer to get into SET training, surgical education training. Her specialty of choice is orthopedics. Rahul is also a surgical resident. He's also happy to have received a letter of offer to get into surgical training, and his specialty of choice is also orthopedics. both enter the training program at the age of 30 years of age. The training program is at least 5 years, plus maybe 1 or 2 years of fellowship, plus maybe, plus maybe, plus maybe. And Amy decides she will live like a resident for those 5 years, and then chooses to invest and focuses on buying a property with a view to eventually living in it. Now, usually for surgical registrars, they need to move homes probably every 6 months during training, but this doesn't stop her from getting a home in the city of her choice and renting it out, because she realizes she's able to do this for up to 6 years and still move into it and make it her principal place of residence and not pay potentially any capital gains tax when eventually she decides to sell it in the future. Amy has a normal car, a Hyundai Kona, which she has purchased for secondhand using cash of $25,000. Now, Rahul, on the other hand, chooses to buy a new car. He loves his Tesla Model Y Performance at a cost of $91,400 at the time of recording. He has a monthly repayment of $1,300 as he leases it. Now, according to potential no repair cost, and let's see how this impacts on their opportunity cost between Amy and Rahul, both entering orthopedics, both age 30, both highly intelligent, and both going to be working very hard as an orthopedic registrar. Now, Amy's opportunity cost is $163,000. That's a 7% per annum return over 30 years with an expense ratio of 0.5%, not accounting for taxes. What does that mean? It means if Amy takes that $25,000 and doesn't buy a car and just invest it, over a long period of time, that cost of a car is now $163,000. That's potentially how much she could have made over a long period of time. Now, Rahul's opportunity cost, on the other hand, is $1.38 million. Again, 7% per annum return over 30 years, expense ratio of 0.5%, not accounting for taxes. What that means is Rahul's Tesla just cost him $1.3 million. It was a $1.3 million decision that he just made. Now, I know what you're asking me right now. But Dev, Rahul needs a car anyway. Yes. Does he really need a Model Y Performance? Maybe, maybe not. And this is where doctors get into severe trouble, just by being silly and doing really kind of silly things like this. So if you're an intern listening to this, if you're a medical student listening to this, be like Amy. Don't be like Rahul. Now, if you're buying a car for private use, try and pay cash. It's simple. It's easy. It's a wealth creation strategy. It's not only about mathematics. I know that mathematics, maybe you can borrow a car and interest rate arbitrage and leverage it all, but it's about the behavior. It's about spending money that you have. It's about not spending money that you don't have. And I hope this example between Amy and Rahul explains the concept of opportunity cost. Now, before, in full transparency, I also have this other rule. Try not to buy a car greater than 20% of your yearly after-tax income. So if your yearly after-tax income is around $100,000, you try not to spend too much over $20,000 to buy a car. Aggressive, yes, that's pretty hard to do, but it's a rough guide in terms of what you should be spending. Now, the other rule that I generally have, and I've abided by, is don't buy a new car until you reach net worth status of $1 million. That's a pretty simple rule. You shouldn't buy a brand new car at the expense of reaching your net worth millionaire status. So if you are not a net worth millionaire, you have to ask yourself, do you really need to buy a brand new car? Because it's a bit risky. Again, there might be unique situations, like if you're in a profession that's driving around all the time and you need a 5-star rating, or you need 5-star ANCAP star rating, which I think is really important. I think every car, you know, if you're going to buy a car, please at least buy a safe car. If you're going to spend the money, then buy a safe car. And I get it, like it can be quite tricky, but those are all sort of basic guidelines that you can potentially use, albeit a little bit aggressive, maybe too aggressive, I'm not sure. Now, the last mistake that I want to talk about before we close up for this episode is under-insuring themselves. Now, I've done plenty of episodes about personal insurance. It is so, so important. Just last month, I spoke to a FASM doctor, an emergency medicine specialist, 38 years old, one child at home, not insured, and did not know anything about a binding death nomination for superannuation either. It is concerning that doctors do not get insurance or underinsured. The irony meaning almost most of us focus on treating patients with sickness. It's a bit weird to note a lot of doctors don't actually have personal insurance early in their career. Meanwhile, we're treating sick people. In 2023, I've spoken to four doctors who've all encountered serious health crises. everything from breast cancer to transient ischemic attacks, heart attacks, and bowel cancer. Just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you're immune to illnesses. It can be argued some illnesses are more prevalent, particularly when it comes to mental health conditions like depression, anxiety. I don't really have any raw data on this, but we know doctors do have one of the highest, unfortunately, suicide rates compared to other professions. And we also know that shift workers, there's some data around that suggests that we are more prone to heart attacks, more prone to cancers. Now, the insurance that I think we should consider, and again, we've got Phil Thompson coming on board to do an interview with me specifically, a lot of these questions will be answered, is life insurance, income protection, trauma insurance. And I think TPD is good to have, but in my view, the definition of what is total and permanent disability can be tough to meet. And if you can afford it, it's good to have. If you can't afford it, it's probably the one that you might want to give the boot to. And what about insuring their partners? This is good to have insurance for your partners too, even if they're not doing any what we call paid work, because, you know, a lot of stay-at-home parents, it's hard work to stay at home looking after kids. So even if they're not doing any paid work, they are working. And the reason why it's really important is because even if they stay at home, even if they're unpaid, if they get sick, it has major implications for your income generating capacity. You can factor in sick leave, annual leave, long service leave, if you wish, when it comes to protect your family financially. So is insurance necessary? Absolutely. And the earlier you get it, the more likely you won't have any exclusions, the cheaper it is, and likely it's going to be a lot easier to get as well with limited health checks. It's pretty hard to get affordable insurance once you hit the 40 mark. And if you have any major diagnosis, some insurance companies just turn you away and say you're not insurable. So speak to an insurance broker or wait till we release an episode with Phil when he comes on board. I would recommend always speaking to an insurance expert rather than doing it all yourself. And the other thing when getting insurance is be as specific in terms of occupational definition as possible, right? Try to avoid any occupation because a doctor's profession is unique. If you're a specialist doctor, then make sure it's included in the insurance. A plastic surgeon can't work as a GP purely because they don't have the credentials. There are restrictions of practice. There is scope of practice issues. There are training requirements. It's kind of like asking a carpenter to switch to being a plumber the next day. I'm sure there's qualifications and credentialing requirements there as well. Is it expensive? Damn right it is. Income protection is probably the most expensive one, followed up by trauma and critical illness insurance. But remember, income protection is actually tax deductible. Life insurance is dirt cheap. TPD can be expensive. So think about it. Try and get your family insured. Try and get yourself insured. Because as a doctor, your biggest investment, in my opinion, is your livelihood. In fact, that's true for any profession. It doesn't have to be a doctor. So it's a little bit crazy to think that a lot of doctors out there wandering around with no personal insurance. Adequate insurance is also very important. There is no point getting insurance and being underinsured. So think about the following things. Number one is stepped versus level premiums. Number two is age until 65 insurance versus time limited insurance. Number three is what are your likely liabilities? What do you have? And what would happen if you died? Now, in my practice, I see so many people who get sick, who are underinsured or not even insured at all. Especially my patients who get injuries, especially those that are high-risk professions like builders and tradespersons, and those that operate heavy machinery, the number of injuries I see is quite staggering. A simple fracture of the hand putting you out of practice for 6 weeks can have a devastating implication on your road to recovery if you don't have emergency funds to meet the requirements to continue with your lifestyle. And this is not uncommon. In fact, we've had one of our doctors who fractured their hand and couldn't work because you can't do hand hygiene, you can't suture, you can't treat patients. So that's about it for this episode. Let's call this part one. So the five mistakes the doctors make. In the next episode, I will address some more mistakes. There are five more that everyone needs to be aware of. Now, remember to leave a 5-star review on Devraka Personal Finance on Apple Podcast or whatever platform you may be using. And please leave a review on all of the platforms. That's even better. And please leave a positive review because I think it's really important that this information gets out. So the positive review gets picked up by the algorithms and therefore gets distributed to various people and share these episodes with your friends and family. I think it's really important. If you're a doctor, share it with your junior. If you're a senior, share it with your senior. If you're a junior, share it with your colleagues. If you're a nurse, share it with your doctors. If you're a doctor, share it with the nurse. Make sure these podcasts are spread across. It doesn't have to be just mine. It can be other people's podcasts as well. Of course, I prefer mine, of course. Now, my name's Dev Raga. This is Dev Raga Personal Finance. And until next time, please make sure you stay safe.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.